Morning.
I'm going to introduce you. Good morning. I'm Tim Burkett, the guiding teacher here, and I'm very happy to introduce our speaker, Ben Connolly, who's been a priest in training here for so long that I can barely remember, and has a wonderful new book coming out this summer.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Tim. Good to see you all. Lovely to be here in the spring. Lovely to be here in the winter. Lovely to be here in the summer. And lovely to be here in the fall. So this talk is entitled, This Is How It Is, An Opportunity. And I will use as a resource some writings on cooking from the Zen tradition for elucidating this topic. So this is how it is, an opportunity. In conventional terms, I could just say what I'm talking about is focusing on responding to the situation with the most helpful thing that you can do. Which is undoubtedly what every one of us does in every moment, all the time, I know. So, let's have tea. Focus on responding to the situation with the most helpful thing. This is how it is. It's an opportunity to do something helpful. So maybe you could say this is in contradiction to, this is how I don't like it to be, how can I get what I want? Or, this is what I want, how can I get it? Or, this is what's wrong with you, can I explain that to you? Ever popular. So, now, there's also sort of a deeper level. So what I'm talking about with this is how it is, an opportunity. Just to say, this is how it is, sometimes we might say thusness, or things as it is, or as it isness. This side of this equation, this balance between this is how it is and an opportunity, is about something that's beyond anything we can conceive of or understand. So not just beyond our likes and dislikes, but beyond anything we do with our mind to separate things. And hopefully I'll make more sense of that as we go through. This opportunity, on maybe you might say a more Buddhist level, we could say we have an opportunity to offer our effort with no expectation of getting a particular result. Or we could say offering our bodhisattva intention in this moment, our intention to do our best to benefit everything in the universe. Or we could say this opportunity is an opportunity to transform karma. Uh-oh. The K word. Don't worry. I'm not going to make any of you be reborn in a hell realm. Hopefully. With this talk. So true. And I just will throw this out there for those of you who are in practice period and been spending all this time with Shitu and his, or Sekito if you prefer, and his teachings on the darkness and the light. This is how it is. It's the darkness. It's the fact that we think we know everything, but actually there's something completely beyond any way of knowing that's happening in every moment. So we look at the world and we think we know what it is. But we actually have the capacity to see through these illusions that are created by our mind and see something that could not be put into words. It's beyond any kind of knowledge or separation. Something in which there are not things, there's not a you that's separate from other things. And this opportunity is the realm of the light, where there are things. There's like a microphone, I'm supposed to put my mouth near. There's some friends of mine here. I'm supposed to offer my effort to try and do my best for you guys. This is how it is. An opportunity. So, I want to read a little story out of this new book, which is really great, called The Hidden Lamp. And one of the editors of The Hidden Lamp will be here on Friday. It's totally coincidental that I'm going to read out of it. But this is really a pretty great book and an important addition to American Buddhist literature. Anyway, and this is teachings of contemporary and long ago Buddhist women. There are you could spend a lot of time unpacking the feminist issues of this story that I'm going to read, and it will probably be a very valuable undertaking. However, I'm not going to do that today. So I'm going to talk about This Is How It Is, An Opportunity. In terms of this story, which is entitled Awakening While Cooking, this is from the 6th century before the Common Era in India. So this is a contemporary of the historical Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama. It comes from the Pali Canon, which is the earliest records we have of Buddhism. A married Brahmin woman went to hear the Buddha teach, and she was so moved by the Dharma that she became a lay disciple. Later, she heard the nun, Mahapajapati, teach. Come on in. Are there any seats?
No.
A couple left? Later, she heard the nun, Mahapajapati, teach, and she wanted to ordain. You may have to look. Later, she heard the nun Mahapajapati teach, and she wanted to ordain as a nun herself, but her husband would not allow it. She continued to practice as a lay Buddhist as best she could, still carrying out the obligations of a Brahmin wife. One day, as she was cooking curry in the kitchen, the meal caught fire, and with a great crackling, burst into flames. In that moment, she had a deep insight into the teaching of impermanence, and she attained the third stage of awakening. From then on, she gave up wearing jewels or ornaments, as if she were already a nun. When her husband asked her about this, she told him she was no longer capable of living a domestic life. So together they went to Mahapajapati, and at last the wife ordained, to her great joy. Shortly afterward, she became an arhat. Arhat is like, basically, enlightened being. So, you could talk about this story for a long time. I'm going to be somewhat brief and stick to my theme, which is here's a person who really felt a huge calling to enter into this practice. What she wanted to do was leave her home, leave her family, give up all her material possessions, shave her head, and live a homeless life, and devote herself entirely to doing this practice. I don't know why her husband didn't like that idea. But like I say, let's not go into that. But the circumstances were such that she chose not to do that. She stayed in her home and, in a sense, fulfilled her duties as a Brahmin wife. So most of us here are fulfilling some conventional social duties. A lot of people with jobs. I don't know why, but here we are with our jobs and our families. And she just did the practice. So she really wanted to do, I want to go to the monastery. I want to go on retreat, whatever it is. But instead, she just stayed where she was, and she did the practice there. And in the act of cooking, a simple domestic act, somehow she had an experience of letting go of these tendencies she had to turn her life into suffering. And she saw that because things are impermanent, they're all flowing and all connected. And at that point, she didn't say, hey, everyone in my family, I'm really awesome. Get out of my way. She just said, you know, I don't want to focus on all this looking really great like we're supposed to do in these Brahmin families. I'm just going to let go of these jewels. That just doesn't matter to me. So in each case, she said, this is how it is. This is my opportunity. I'm here in this house. I'm not satisfied with being in this house, but I'm going to do my practice here. And what she had that allowed for this big opening and awakening. And then actually an awakening is when you're seeing more clearly how it is. What she saw more how it is, what she did is she didn't make demands. She didn't try and control things. She just saw, I have an opportunity to let go of something that doesn't serve me anymore, which is this real focus in this culture on my appearance. Now, I'm not saying people shouldn't focus on their appearance. I'm saying this is the choice she made. Her response was to make a choice for herself that was true to herself. You know, I thought this story made sense because none of us seem to be wandering off into the woods and shaving, well, some of us shave our heads. Looking good. giving up all our possessions, you know, we're not doing that. But we still have the opportunity to practice. The opportunity to practice is not somewhere else. How many of us are waiting? Oh, finally, I'm going to go to a retreat, and then I'm going to get really still. Well, we all know you go to a retreat, you just go nuts. Well, maybe a little bit at a time. We also do become very still. We go on retreat, we get the whole vast range of what it is to be human. And we see that vast range of being human comes not from some external thing, but just from being human. Because there's no external thing. We're just sitting there with a wall. We watch our mind make it all. But we may think, oh, that other place. Yeah, I'm going to go to Hokyoji, and there's going to be the birds and the trees, and that's what I'm going to get back to the mountains. I'm finally going to find some peace. This woman just said, I'm going to do my practice here. And it was when she had a fire in her kitchen that she woke up. An opportunity. So you can ask yourself this as you go through your life. What am I doing? Am I taking this opportunity to serve what really matters to me? My deepest intention? Keep coming back to that. Because the truth is, most people don't, you know. That's the way the human mind works. It's what we call samsara in Buddhism. And you know, this is our practice of Zazen is really intimate with this process. I mean, Zazen is kind of like a complete compaction of this is how it is, an opportunity, because what we do when we practice Zazen, we just go, oh, this is how it is, right? This is how it is. This is how it is. This is how it is. Yeah, well, then a lot of the time we just think about stuff. But our practice is to come out and say, oh, this is how it is. And actually, our opportunity is to make the effort to be with this is how it is. And the fact that we're with this is how it is what feeds our capacity to take that opportunity. If we don't have a taste of how it is, it's very hard to find a crack in our conditioned tendency to just turn life into this is what I want and this is what I don't, and how am I going to fix it? So I thought I'd talk a little bit about another guy who likes cooking, Dogen Zenji. Dogen founded the Soto Zen School, of which we are a part here, in the 13th century? I think so. In Japan. And when he was studying in China, some of the people who really impressed him the most were the cooks there. And he wrote this beautiful essay about, it's called Instructions to the Cook, or Instructions to the Tenzo. We'll be studying this in morning study group next month. Join in. Or if you're interested, you can ask me about it. And, you know, I would argue that one of the most distinctive features of Soto Zen is the emphasis put on just doing whatever you're doing with your whole heart, whatever it is. You have a big emphasis on Zazen, and you have a big emphasis on doing what you're doing with your whole heart, because Zazen is one of the most excellent opportunities for doing whatever you're doing with your whole heart. And so we talk about this a lot here, and Dogen's writings often are... how many people have read Dogen and been like, I have no idea what any of this is talking about? Yeah. How many people have read Dogen and have never had that experience? Okay, cool. So actually, this is one of Dogen's, I would argue, more accessible works. It's certainly one of his most practical ones. And he talks, in my opinion, extensively about this practice of seeing that this is how it is, an opportunity. I'll read a little passage. When you wash rice and prepare vegetables, you must do it with your own hands and with your own eyes, making sincere effort. Do not be idle even for a moment. Do not be careful about one thing and careless about another. Do not give away your opportunity, even if it is merely a drop in the ocean of merit. Do not fail to place even a single particle of earth at the summit of the mountain of wholesome deeds. So he's pointing out something really central to Buddhism, which is the preciousness of having a moment of human consciousness. We have a culture that does not emphasize this preciousness. It's trivializing human life moment after moment, trying to focus on consuming things or judging people from other sides of the fence, or distract. How fast can we get these pages to move through? You know, we have people who design web pages that are supposed to attract us, and then the whole purpose is just to get us to click to the next one, because there'll be another banner ad, and you sell page views. We have a culture that's designed to take us away from the awesome and amazing importance of each moment. And this is not new. I mean, at the very root of Buddhism, Buddha was saying, you have an opportunity. Everyone suffers. You suffer and everyone else suffers. And all I'm saying is that you have an opportunity right now to practice and maybe place even a single particle of earth at the summit of the mountain of wholesome deeds. The Dogen's not going to pretend that it's like, yeah, you fixed everything. It's just a particle. He's not going to pretend we're not in the dreadful existential situation of being kind of small in something vast. But he's saying it doesn't matter. At least you've got this. What else are you going to do with your life? Really? You get done with your life and be like, yeah, I had 4 iPhones. I remember when I got the Generation 3 or whatever. I'm sorry, I always pick on iPhones. 4 Telecasters. Whatever. Yeah, you... Mark knows what I'm talking about. Listen, I only have one. He also points out the importance of just focusing on our part. Our part. This is not an opportunity to fix other people or change other things. It's an opportunity to offer effort. Do it with your own hands, with your own eyes, making sincere effort. Hands and eyes. The basic simple symbol of Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion. The embodiment of compassion in this tradition is always depicted with thousands of hands, each with an eye in it. Perception and activity harmonized for the purpose of serving everyone. thing here. When preparing the vegetables and the soup ingredients to be cooked, do not discuss the quantity or quality of these materials which have been obtained from the monastery officers. Just prepare them with sincerity. Most of all, you should avoid getting upset or complaining about the quantity of food materials. You should practice in such a way that things come and abide in your mind, and your mind returns and abides in things all through the day and night. And this could get sort of complicated, but he points out here the primacy of karma in this situation. So just cooking for people you love is really good. But in this tradition, there's a big emphasis on realizing that the activities that we do are conditioned by the past. People tend to do things that they did before. People who are angry tend to experience anger. People who are sad tend to experience sadness. People who are joyful tend to experience joy. And that's actually the meaning of karma at its most basic and earliest Buddhist understanding, although there are other understandings of karma throughout Buddhism and other cultures. But if you look at the earliest teachings of Buddha and really the way usually Dogen's going to talk about it, he's just talking about patterning of mind. And one of the key components to patterning the mind is, one, it's good to feel joyful. You're more likely to feel joyful on another occasion. That's why Thich Nhat Hanh says, smile. It's hard for me. You know, he's like, smile while you're doing zazen. I'm like, well, that's tough. You know, I thought we were supposed to look, you know, kind of, well, I try sometimes. I'm willing to try. Not only is it the case that we condition the mind by whatever the mind is experiencing, but there is a huge importance, particularly in early Buddhism, of seeing what the mind is doing and being intimate with it. Mindfulness of emotional and volitional tendencies of mind. And to put a long story short, you should do that. Just do that. It will be helpful. If you see tendencies come into mind, it disarms them, and it makes less likely that you'll just have to eat them again. And you can make a different soup. And I point that out here because he's talking about mind. You should see all these things as abiding and coming into mind and going out of mind. So realizing the real importance that your mind has in the way you're processing this whole experience. You know, we go through life just thinking, yeah, this soup sucks. It's like, no, it's just whatever it is. It's an opportunity. Okay. So now Dogen's going to get... He's going to enter into the trippy Dogen realm. When you prepare food, do not see with ordinary eyes and do not think with ordinary mind. Take up a blade of grass and construct a treasure king's land. Enter into a particle of dust and turn the great Dharma wheel. Do not arouse disdainful mind when you prepare a broth of wild grasses. Do not arouse a joyful mind when you prepare a fine cream soup. When there is no discrimination, how can there be distaste? Thus, do not be careless even when you work with poor materials, and sustain your efforts even when you have excellent materials. Never change your attitude according to the materials. If you do, it is like you're varying your behavior when speaking with different people. Then you are not a practitioner of the way. Sometimes the materials with which my mind are operating seem rather poor. You know, I'm just grumpy and complaining. And he's saying, well, that's how it is. That's your opportunity. And of course, there's the possibility that I may be like, whoa, I'm feeling all calm and peaceful, feeling present. Why would I need to do zazen? Right? He's saying, just sit down. don't wake up and go, I'm upset, so I better sit down. And don't wake up and say, I'm feeling great, so I'll sit down. Just sit down. Sustain your practice. Don't go into your mind and try and figure out when's the time. It's always the time. It's always the time. There's always this opportunity. The first half of this, he begins to open up into what I was talking about at the beginning a little bit, where this things that, what was I saying? This is how it is. So we might, in a conventional way, it's just like, this is how it is about not zooming off into the future or focusing on what you want it to be, but just really going, this is how it is, you know. My son is really upset. What am I going to do? Instead of, what the hell is wrong with him? Right? Whatever. But this is how it is as a deeper thing, and this is what, you know, Suzuki will call things as it is, or, you know, frequently called suchness or thusness. How it is not how we think it is. How we think it is still covered over by tons of judgments that we have. And for most of us who've done a lot of zazen, sometimes you start to see less and less coverings, right? And you just be like, you forget that it's a wall that you're looking at. It's, I don't know what it is. It's white. I'm not even busy calling it white. And we see the sensations in the body, and we don't have to think, oh, I'm breathing in, I'm breathing out. You just feel intimately those sensations without layering any conceptions onto it. So we can let go of not only the more gross level, long cognitive trains of thought about how we like or don't want things or want to control them. We can begin to let go of even the subtle levels of liking and disliking. And we can let go even the subtle levels of trying to figure out what the material and the visual field is. You know? Or we can let go of figuring out what time it is. And sometimes you'll be sitting here on a retreat sometime and you might just go, is there time? Is there time? Just an idea. We have a lot of ideas that are deeply ingrained. And so he says, take up a blade of grass and construct a treasure king's land. You can't do that. Of course you can't do that. And of course you can. Because there's no gap between the tiniest thing and the vastest thing. Enter into a particle of dust and turn the great Dharma wheel. How can you enter into a particle of dust? It's there. I can see, everybody, this particle of dust is there and I'm here. But we can actually know that there is no gap. We can realize that there is no gap. That the gap is just a tendency of our mind. That may seem improbable. That's okay. That's okay with me. It's just words. But when we can operate out of this place, we feel what? Connection? Harmony? Openness? And he gives us some clues as to how to open up to this kind of expansive sense that is beyond all conceptions. Do not arouse a disdainful mind when you prepare a broth of wild grasses, and do not arouse a joyful mind when you prepare fine cream soup. So just do what you're doing with your whole heart and just take it easy. This false perceptions, like, ah, oh, this, what am I? I'm glad, I've never had to make a soup out of wild grasses, I'll admit. And I'll confess that I might have a bad attitude about it if I had to feed all you guys with wild grass. I would do my best. But this false perceptions, these judgments, liking and disliking, this naming, this separation, this tendency of the mind to make us seem like we're something separate from everything else, it steals our opportunity. Steals our opportunity. When you are caught, when we are caught by this story about, oh, these stupid, what's wrong with Congress? Why can't those guys ever get anything together? I mean, I thought I liked the Democrats, and they're all just corrupt anyway, and I think all they want to do is stay in office. But stealing my opportunity, stealing it. All I'm doing is being swept away in my judgments. And I could take the opportunity to say, oh, that's a thought. I have a feeling that's aversive. Oh, this is how it is. This is the wild grass soup I have, is all my aversion about this and my sense of powerlessness and my wanting to complain and blame things on other people. Oh, this is how it is. This is an opportunity to go deeper. How is it in my body? Oh, yeah, tension. Oh, I have an opportunity to go deeper. How is this? What is all of this? And we can expand and people can do things. Oh, we don't do it perfectly. But, you know, last year, I think my son joined the Young Democrats because he wanted something to put on his resume so he could get into college. But he may also have joined the Young Democrats at his high school because he wanted to do something helpful. And actually, I know that both of those things were true. So he did not have a perfect intention, but he just wanted to do something helpful. He did. He wanted to get something for himself. He went, they usually go together. We're not going to do any of this perfectly. But, you know, they were doing their thing, and they noticed, hey, we think Obama is going to win. And then they said, well, here we are. We've already figured out how to get a lot of people to come to these meetings by buying pizza. It turns out my son is a genius. Anyway, so they have these people come to the meetings for the pizza, and they're like, well, you know, we could do stuff, but we feel like, you know, Obama's going to win this state, so what we could do? And they looked around, and they said, you know what's close is this amendment people are proposing to make it so that gay people can't get married, an amendment to our Constitution. They said, that's actually close. We're going to do something. This is how it is, and we have an opportunity. And they went out and they rode their bikes around and they knocked on people's doors and they went to concerts and registered 18-year-old people to vote, because guess what? 18-year-old people don't support that amendment. And they went out and they did a little work. They put a drop of sand on the top of the mountain of benevolent action. And on election day, that amendment failed by a margin of something like 0.5%. So, you know, we could sit around and complain about people far away who are doing things wrong, or we can see something we can do, and we can say, this is how it is. It's an opportunity. And, of course, I've done similar things to what he did, and the people I was promoting did not win. Right? But this isn't about getting the result you want. It's about offering your effort. I'd like to say something about something else. Have you measured correctly or not? Have the others consulted? You consulted, counted the number of people at the monastery correctly or not? You should review this closely and clarify it, directing the kitchen according to the situation. This kind of practice, effort after effort, day after day, should never be neglected. So he's talking about, you know, checking in with people. How many people are at the place? How much food do we need? It's actually kind of hard to do. I'll be honest, it's a little hard to do your Zen practice when you have to do this. This is why we start out saying, introduction to Zen meditation. Have a cushion. Usually in this tradition, we're going to start by helping us just sit down and reduce the number of things that we have to figure out completely. You know? You don't have to figure anything out. Someone else is going to ring the bell. You don't have to figure out when to stand up or sit down, right? You just come in here, and you're relieved of all cognitive duties. This is a relief. Come in here for some relief. You have a lot of duties. It's an opportunity. So, anyway, we start that way. But if you stick around, pretty soon someone's going to say, hey, guy, could you come in here before everyone gets here and ring the bells and set everything up? And so you get a little task. You get a little task, and you get... So you we start to add just a little bit of cognitive activity into your practice. It's like sifting it in there, right? Because it's hard. You know, the first time I rang the bells, I was like, man, boy, I'm the best bell ringer in your life. Whoa. And then I hit it wrong, and I was like, oh, my God, I'm a horrible person. You know, so, it you know, we need a little help. You don't want to just start, like, being Eno, right? You get a lot of thinking when you're the Eno to go with your practice. We take a little time before we put you there. So it helps to have this sitting at the basis to give you a chance, just to give you a chance to taste this, to open up to your capacity to see how it is and take the opportunity. The cycle of the Tenzo's work begins after the noon meal. First, go to the director and assistant director to receive the ingredients for the next day's morning and noon meals, rice, vegetables, and so on. After you have received these materials, take care of them as you would your own eyes. Zen Master Baoneng Renyong said, protect the property of the monastery, it is your eyeball. Respect the food as though it were for the emperor. Take the same care for all food, raw or cooked. So that's some rhetoric right there. What the heck? Take care of this as if it were your own eyes. The first time I heard this, it was misquoted by a fellow named Daikaku from San Francisco Zen Center, who was sitting here, and he said, cut the carrots as if they were your own eyeballs. Or maybe that's a kind of... I was like, wow. He's like, damn! I mean, that's... Yeah. That's more than I can take. But, take care of them as you would your own eyes. We're talking about a harmony between perception, activity, perceiver, and perceived. And within that total harmony, that realizing that they're not separate things, that they are just thusness. Within realizing that, what do? We take care. Take care. This is how it is. In this moment, there's no carrot outside of my seeing of the carrot. There's no activity outside of my taking care of the carrot by cutting it. There's an old koan about hands and eyes, perception and activity, and harmony, in which one monk asks another, what is it like when the bodhisattva of compassion, the embodiment of compassion, is always manifesting total heart? What is it like when Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion, is using all those hands and eyes? And his friend says, it's like reaching for a pillow in the night. Very simple. The bodhisattva of compassion doesn't have to come home from work at the end of the day and say, oh man, I need a beer. You will not believe what happened. Because it's easy. It can be really easy. It's not always easy. I know it's not always easy for me, and I know it's not always easy for you, but it can be so easy to step in to just seeing and doing the most helpful thing. It can be. That opportunity is there. We begin to touch that opportunity by sitting down on this cushion and just offering ourselves again and again. Well, thank you. I think that's what I like to say about that. And I will invite comments or questions. An opportunity, if you will. Okay, yes, so I have here, one book is called The Hidden Lamp. It's very new. And one is called Moon in a Dewdrop. It's translations of selections from Dogen by Kazuaki Tanahashi. He's not only a wonderful translator, but an amazing calligrapher. And has quite a beard, too. It's a beautiful book. And we'll be using it for morning study group. Well, shall we just move along, my friends? Okay, thank you.